Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery. And that is why the Machinery Digest exists. A no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Welcome to Idle Chatter from the Farm Machinery Digest. I'm Ray Bohax, your host and the farmer from New Jersey, coming to you from a dryland farmer with wetland. So hopefully everything is going well on your operation, and I guess it would not be an agricultural / farm show, right, if we didn't talk about our crops and about the weather before we got into the subject matter today, which is going to be electrolysis and cylinder liner cavitation erosion, in case you were wondering. But first, we need to give you a crop update, and I only wish that I could hear from you guys, that I wish that this was a dialogue and not a monologue. But the crop update over here on the Bohax farm in Warren County, New Jersey, is ditto of the past three or four shows. It's been wet, it's been cloudy, and it's been cool. We did have a nice day the other day. It was about 78 degrees, which is not that warm. But I really had like most of you, I've had a challenging week with ups and downs, with the potential of having something dry out, and then those hopes dashed as rain fell from the sky again, and a cold, damp rain nonetheless. But, you know, over here, I really need to come clean with you, because I feel that God put this on my heart, and you know, maybe somebody out there needs to hear this, and I hope and I pray that if they do need to hear this, that it is able to bring them comfort, and maybe I just need to hear myself say it, so maybe I am the one that needs to hear it. But you know, we've never had any standing water in our field, so it's not of the devastation over here that you see on television in different parts of the country, by no means, shape or form. It's just been too wet to plant. And what happened the other day, I think it was last Wednesday, I went to go plant, and it was just not good. The field was too wet, and our soil, when it does get wet, it has a tendency to tighten up even more, and then when it dries out, it actually becomes a little bit looser. So I'm not saying it was super saturated, because it was still holding the water. As I said, there was no puddles or anything, but it was just too wet to plant, and I went out there, and it really did not go well, and the seed trench wasn't closing. I think I was mudding in the corn. I had a lot of down cover crop that was just causing problems, as I said, the week before, and basically repeat of everything. And then I got out of the field that evening. I was crawling around on the ground looking to see whether I could find some seed in the furrow, and I don't want to say it was a depressing moment. It was a discouraging moment, because as a Christian, I'm never depressed. And my hope is in the Lord, so I'm never depressed. But what I really did was surprise myself on how and I don't want to say my lack of faith, because that's really not true, but how my faith, I guess, was not strong enough to be able to give it to the Lord that evening, as I left the field just before it got dark with a planter full of mud and no seed in the ground. And so I was hoping for, you know, better conditions the next day and the next morning after I came back from coffee early in the morning. As I've said before, I go down to the truck stop, the TA truck stop, for coffee in the morning, and then I come back and I stop and check my crops. And I was walking around in the field, and it was just a raw, cold day. It was 47 degrees. It was 42 when I left at 5 o'clock in the morning. When I got home, it was 47, so it warmed up a little bit, and it was just cold rain falling. It wasn't a heavy rain, but it was just very dreary and very discouraging. And I went out in the field to try to see what damage I did, or try to just, I don't know what I was looking for. I guess just coming back to the scene of the crime, right, from the night before. And It was quite discouraging and disappointing. And then at that particular moment, I just realized that, you know, I am blessed to farm. And I hope that anyone that's going through struggles that are much worse than I am going through here. I mean, everybody's farm is different. Everybody's life is different. It's just like DNA. Everyone is different, and everybody's situation is different. Your financial situation is different. Your farm condition is different. Your family situation is different. But we all do have the same hopes and dreams, and we all do have the same Creator. And I've always said I know that I'm blessed to farm, but sometimes I forget that with the 2 weeks before when I broke the sprayer. So, but you know, that morning, I just, you know, the Lord took that situation of standing out in that cold rain and looking at that field, and actually having 2 sweatshirts on in June, and he used that to take my faith to a higher level. Because as I looked out in despair, I just gave it to him. I gave plant 19 to him, and I felt a surreal peace that surpassed all understanding, as the scripture said, that just came over me. And I just gave my hope to him for that, and I said, his will be done. If the Lord wants a crop in the field, it'll be there. The crop that I do have is not going to be on any cover of a magazine or a seed cover, because my emergence is spotty at best. It looks like a bad haircut when you look across the field, because some corn is taller, some are shorter. But that's his will. It's his will to be done. And when I gave that to him, I just got this peace in my heart and this calmness, and it was just a wonderful feeling. The situation in the field hasn't changed, but I have changed. So I know a lot of you are struggling with this, and rightfully so. Your livelihood depends upon it, your farm depends upon it, your family depends upon it, and we just need to give it to the Lord. And in a small way, like I say, my situation here is nowhere near as dire as most of you that are out there listening to this. But I just hope that someone hears this message and they go out in the field and they just give that crop, they give that soil, they give everything to the Lord, and you'll have that peace in your heart, and he will guide you and make the right decisions. So maybe I was the one who needed to hear this again today. So I want to thank you so much for allowing me to share that with you. But hopefully I'm going to do my best to give you a great show today. I'm pumped up. I'm talking about, talking about, as I said, about electrolysis and cylinder line of cavitation in engines. And most of the time people think just of diesel engines for cylinder line of cavitation, and that's predominantly is true wet sleeve diesels, and we'll get into that. But electrolysis inside an engine is a phenomenon that can happen to any liquid-cooled engine, and it's almost like sudden death syndrome in soybeans. It's a hidden cancer. It's a hidden disease inside an engine, and that once it shows itself in so many ways, it's like a pancreatic cancer. That by the time it shows its symptoms and presents itself, it's way too late. And if anyone has had a loved one or a friend or a family member that's had pancreatic cancer, that you know what I'm talking about. So, and that's really what electrolysis is. By the time you see it, by the time it shows itself, it's really way too late. And to a certain extent, cylinder line of cavitation erosion. And those two diseases will definitely wreck an engine. So we're going to explain those and discuss those today. And then we also have an interesting letter. It's from a gentleman out in Las Vegas, Nevada, who listens to the show, and he has a question about gas mileage, about fuel economy. So that is going to be in our special delivery segment that's brought that I bring to you at the end of the show before we close, and that is brought to you by Firestone Ag. So this fuel economy, even though he's talking about a car, but this would apply to any gasoline engine that you have on the farm or your personal vehicle. So that will be at the end of the show. But before we do get going about electrolysis, I do want to tell you once more about the Agro Expo, and that is being held in St. John's, Michigan, August 13th and 14th. It is a premier learning event. I don't like to call it a field day, even though in its proper sense it is a field day, but it is out in the field, but it is an educational event, and its emphasis is on education and getting you to become a better farmer and to navigate the obstacles that come in our way when we're trying to grow a crop as far as fertility is concerned and all aspects of that plant going from germination to harvest. But what's really interesting about the Agro Expo, and it's the Agro Expo, you could look them up, is that obviously they cover the row crops, but they're also very interested in a whole eclectic array of crops. So whether you're an orchardman, whether you're a vegetable guy, no matter whether you have a vineyard, or even if you grow coffee, then the Agro Expo has something for you. So it's in St. John's, Michigan. It's 100% free. And look them up, the Agro Expo, August 13th and 14th of this year. And it is quickly becoming a premier educational field day. This is not a fun field. And not that you can't have fun there, but it's education. And if you're listening to this show, you know that I am about education. So it's not that I don't like having a good time, but I'm about education. And that's really what we need to do. As things get harder on the farm, as things get more challenging, there's also more opportunity within those challenges. And the Agro Expo will help you to not only explore for those opportunities, but to be able to take them and make them a true profit center for your farm. So please check that out. So, all right, we're going to talk about electrolysis, and we'll finish up today's show with cylinder liner cavitation erosion. That's a mouthful, right? Most people that are listening that have diesel engines are familiar with cylinder liner cavitation erosion, and even if they're not truly familiar with it to the extent that they should be, that they're cognizant of it and they understand that it happens and they realize that problem is basically coolant based, that the additive package in the coolant, and we've discussed this before, the additive package in the coolant becomes depleted, and then what happens is that the coolant actually, the vibration of combustion inside the engine with a wet liner meaning that the bore is not the parent material of the block. It's a sleeve that's inside the block and vibrates in all simple terms and creates air bubbles, and these air bubbles, believe it or not, have the ability to erode the liner. We're going to go on to that later on, and once the liner gets eroded, then it is able to put coolant into the cylinder and also put coolant into the oil, so which is not good. But what a lot of people are not familiar with is something that is just as destructive, cannot be checked with a test strip. You know, what's good about cylinder liner cavitation is that you could keep after your coolant, you could maintain your coolant, make sure all the supplemental coolant additives are in there, or there's fresh coolant in the engine, and then cylinder liner cavitation is like completely off the map. Forget about it. You don't have to worry about it. There's no concern with that whatsoever. You know, it's like paying your taxes, right? You pay your taxes, you don't have to worry about anybody knocking on your door. So the cylinder liner a deal we could actually eliminate by just doing good maintenance procedure. But what happens with electrolysis is that it is much more evasive. No matter how well you maintain that particular engine or that piece of equipment, is that it could start to evoke electrolysis. Because what electrolysis is, that's a mouthful, electrolysis is, right? It's the ground path of an electrical circuit using the coolant instead of its natural ground. So basically, in essence, let me rephrase that sentence so you can understand it better. When electrolysis occurs, when the ground for some particular circuit on that piece of equipment or that engine makes no difference. It's actually more of a piece of equipment than the engine. Is poor, is a high impedance ground, and what's going on is that the electricity wanting to go to ground is using the coolant as a conduit. And what happens is that when it uses the coolant as a conduit, it will actually eat away and erode the metal in the engine. And the cylinder liner on a diesel engine is very, very prone to that because it's in contact with a large surface area of the coolant. But not only on a diesel engine, it could be a gasoline engine that doesn't have a cylinder liner, so it's not going to find its ground path there, but it would find its ground path through the heater core, through the radiator. It could find its ground path through the intake manifold, or many different places where the coolant comes in contact with the engine block. So we are going to discuss that. And what is bad about this, like a pancreatic cancer, is that it sneaks up on you and you are not aware that that ground path is faulty. And it's eating away, eating away, eating away at this engine until it pops a hole in something or a component fails, like the radiator or intake manifold, or hopefully not the cylinder liner on a diesel engine. So that is, in a nutshell, what electrolysis is about. It is the ground being completed through the coolant instead of its intended source, which is a ground cable, ground wire, what have you. Alrighty? But I want to tell you a little bit of a story. And about 20 years ago, which is frightening, it probably was 20 years ago, that's scary, but I had a contract with BMW of North America, and I've mentioned this to you, to the listeners before, but for the benefit of new listeners, and as I was a test drive engineer, calibration evaluator, and test drive engineer for BMW of North America in the engineering department, which was located in New Jersey, about 60 miles from our farm. And usually what they would do is that they would put a whole, if possible, they would tag team a bunch of tests. So we were doing calibration and tire testing, but then we also threw at the same time brake testing or something else, because you had to drive the car, so you could also test different brake pad materials, different rotor materials, what have you. And if you were doing a calibration test, or the calibration wasn't really a test, it was an evaluation, which is different than a test. The test, you're looking for a result, you're looking for a quantitative number, whereas an evaluation is you're looking for something that's intangible. If the evaluation of the calibration actually produces a quantitative number, then that calibration should never have gotten to that particular point. So it's something where you're looking for idle quality, you're looking for throttle response, you're looking for shift performance, you're looking for a whole bunch of different things, idle flare up on startup, accessory load dump. All right, you bury the power steering coming out of a parking lot. Does it take the load on the engine? Does it have to undershoot the idle and then overshoot? So you're basically evaluating all of this. But we did tire testing and brake pad testing and rotor testing and also the calibration evaluation. So what happened was that at the time it was E46, which was the then new coming out 3-series sedan. And part of the tire testing protocol was for us to return back to the engineering facility via the Garden State Parkway. And we had specified test routes that we could not deviate from. And the reason why we had those test routes is those routes evoked the conditions that we were looking for. It may have been a pavement design, it may have been a type of pavement, it may have been hills or what have you, it may have been a stop and go route. There was all different routes to test different aspects of the vehicle. which is common for all auto manufacturers. This was not something that BMW had a handle on and no one else did. It was a common protocol, and just the test routes would be different. We'd name the different test routes, and then we would go on. So anyway, but we always had to return on the Garden State Parkway and go the last 20 miles on the Garden State Parkway to our engineering facility to bring the cars back. And then for those of you that live in other parts of the country, in the Northeast, what a parkway is a toll road. It's predominantly a toll road. Doesn't have to be, but it's a road. Its primary definition is that it is a road that does not allow any commercial vehicles on it. So it's basically for cars. And if you wanted to take a small van, even like a little minivan on it, it would have to have windows. If it did not have windows, it could not be on it. So there was no commercial vehicles allowed on a parkway. So thus the road, the concrete or the pavement was thinner, and also a lot of the bridge overpasses were lower because they did not have to worry about a commercial vehicle. So motorcycles and passenger cars, no problem on a parkway. And the Garden State Parkway is a toll road. And at the time, they had, the toll was 50 cents. It was almost every couple of miles you had to stop and pay 50 cents at a toll booth. Almost like going through I-80 in Chicago used to be. But I don't even know if that's still there anymore. But anyway, so our instructions were, you could buy tokens because they had a machine that you could throw the token in or throw the change, or they had a change attendant, a person there. Our instruction was to take a token, but do not throw the token in the machine. We needed to hand the token to the toll attendant. And the reason for that being is that we were checking for static electricity from the different tire brands and models that we were running. And it was very important for us to be able to make a note in the log book of whether we got shocked or the toll attendant got shocked from this static electricity. And in the winter time, I would usually go through that part of the, well, not usually, it would be dark when I went through those toll booths to return the car back to the engineering department, and in the summertime it was not. But anyway, so we would pull up to the toll, I would pull up to the toll booth and I would hand the token to the attendant, and I'd have to make note mentally and then write in the logbook whether he or I got shocked. And then we had some tires, and I believe they were a set of Michelins. I don't remember the model. They may have actually been a prototype Michelin tire, because when you're dealing with a car manufacturer, these companies will actually make a certain tread design or a certain pattern for the manufacturer, and that tire would not be able to be replicated. You could buy that tire by brand and by name, but the OE tread pattern often is very different than the one that you would buy as a replacement tire. But anyway, we had these Michelin tires, and I would give that token to the attendant, and in the winter time, it was a spark there like an arc welder, and the guy would usually scream, and he didn't say anything, because what are you going to do? But that's how much static electricity that those particular tires created. And then we had other tires that did not create a lot of static electricity, but interestingly enough is that you could take that same tire, and maybe if the road was wet or it was a different temperature, when you ran a slightly different pressure, its static electricity could go up or could go down, but never really was eliminated. So why I'm telling you this is that to keep in mind that if you have a vehicle, and this is very, very common with semi-trucks, is that, and most farmers who haul grain buy used semi-trucks, and rightfully so, because you're only using them to haul grain a couple of times a year, or throughout the harvest season, and most of the time the truck sits, or you may actually evoke it to haul some loads to keep your guys working, or to make have the truck become some sort of cash flow. But it's common with older semi-trucks, and why I'm saying older is that it meant that they were apart at one particular point. Somebody may have had a transmission out of it. They may have had an engine out. They may have been in a collision. And if the ground circuits that go from the frame to the chassis, from the engine to the chassis, from the body to the chassis, are high impedance or not connected, which is very common. Lots of times during a collision or repair, some of the grounds get left off, not only on semi-trucks, and I'll discuss that later on, but what could very well occur would be this: that truck is rolling down the road. Unbeknownst to you is that you would have be inducing a lot of static electricity. And if that ground path is insufficient because it's high impedance or it's not connected, or out of four grounds there's only two of them that are connected, or sometimes they use a braided cable and the cable actually rotted out over the years from salt, is that it is conceivable and quite possible that that ground is following its path and or terminating its path, as I should say, through the engine coolant and attacking that engine. And it may be attacking the cylinder liner, or it may be attacking other parts of that engine. So that is why this is important for you to understand this. Now, I spoke about tires, and it has been documented, more than you would care to know, documented cases of rebuilt diesel engines in semis that have gone 10 or 20,000 miles and ate a hole in the cylinder liner, put the coolant into the piston, into the bore. The piston came up, as we all know, a liquid is non-compressible, kicked the rod out of the side of the block and blew the engine up. Alrighty? So that is very, very it's more common than we'd like to know, and that is because somebody has left the ground off and or it has a high impedance ground, and that static electricity was generated but could not be released through the normal ground path and was going through the coolant. And why a semi truck is very prone to this is because it has 18 wheels, so there's many more wheels acting as a static generator, and also they run at high speeds, legal limits, we'll say, right, whatever the speed limit is. They're not going 5 miles an hour like a tractor through the field, which creates static electricity, so they run at high speeds and they run for long periods of time. So in its previous use as a line haul truck, and most farmers buy ex-old line haul trucks or even the day cab, and the truck in its previous life was running hundreds of miles a day, and it could very well have been building up the static electricity. The driver was not aware of it, the mechanic was not aware of it, no one was aware of it, all right? And that static electricity most of the time is coming from the tires, and the ground path is not there to cancel it, all right? So that's that, and we're going to go elaborate upon this a little bit more. The other aspect of static electricity and things that cause electrolysis, I put my tongue back in my mouth. Don't think that your combine or your farm tractor or your sprayer is insulated from this. You say, well, my sprayer is not going down the road 500 miles a day, so I don't care. Well, yes, you do, because anything that has an electrical load on that piece of equipment. So, in essence, if you have a planter and it's running its own alternator, a hydraulically run alternator, and have its own voltage source there, you have the potential with a bad ground to have electrolysis form throughout that machine and into that tractor because it is connected. All right, your sprayer is the same thing. Is that you have? Let's talk about the planter. Let's say the planter has an electric fan on its hydraulic cooling system. If that fan has a weak ground and it is going through some sort of liquid, and it may actually be it doesn't have to be the coolant in the engine. I mean, on a vehicle, it's the coolant in the engine. But on a sprayer, it could actually be finding a ground path through a metal pipe from the liquid fertilizer. Not a sprayer, on a planter, liquid fertilizer. Or on a sprayer, it could be doing the same thing. The most common place for it to find the ground path is through the coolant, but it is not the only place if there's other fluids available. So, years ago, back in, I think, it was probably the late 70s or 1980, don't hold me to it. But some Corvettes left the factory with a ground that was not connected, a body ground that was not connected. Now, why I'm telling you this is for twofold. Number one, to see the severity of this, and number two, also to is because a Corvette has a fiberglass body. A lot of tractors today, a lot of farm equipment have fiberglass, what we call it plastic, right? Plastic body panels and a plastic body. It's not like it was years ago where everything was metal. And because the Corvette had a fiberglass body, and fiberglass is not a conductor of electricity, is that they were very critical about having good grounds to eliminate electrolysis. Now, so what happened is that this ground, I don't remember where it was not connected from the factory on some cars, or it was bad or overconnected and broke. I don't know. Let's just call it a high impedance ground, so I don't stumble over my words and bore you with this. And then what was going on was that the cars with the bad ground, the high impedance ground, and you have to remember electricity, you cannot predict electricity. You know, we know it takes the path of least resistance, that we do know, but we don't know what the path of least resistance is. Just like with a lightning strike, it's electricity, it's going to take the path of least resistance, but you don't know where it's going to go. And you may assume and say, hey, there's a pretty good chance it's going to hit that cell phone tower because it's the highest point, and it'll wax right 3 feet away from you on flat land because that was the path of least resistance due to the atmospheric conditions. So we can't anticipate what's going to happen. But for some reason, these Corvettes with the bad ground had the least resistance was to go to ground through the left front wheel bearing. And what would basically happen is that this wheel bearing would start to go bad, and if the person was not paying attention to the bearing talking at them, or they were a person who played the radio very loudly, this didn't happen in 2 seconds, I'm not going to say that. In 2 minutes, a guy went to go get ice cream with his wife, and it would actually weld the wheel bearing to the spindle. It would electro-arc weld the wheel bearing to the spindle, and the wheel would break right off. Now, you know, in defense of General Motors, is that, you know, there was that bearing spoke to you a long time before the wheel broke off, but still, ultimately, that just shows the potential for problems. So, what I want to do is, before I tell you how to check for this, is I want to explain a couple of things, is that there are two areas that cause the most detrimental electrolysis, and that is it's a duty cycle or time. So like the tires running on the road, the truck is being driven 500-600 miles a day, 400 miles a day, 200 miles a day, right? Or the length of time that circuit is evoked. So let's say that you have, and to make it ridiculous, all right, let's say that there's a bad ground circuit, a high impedance ground circuit on the dome light in this piece of equipment. Well, you open a door, the dome light is on for 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 30 seconds, you close the door, the dome light goes out. Alrighty? And so the time that the electrons would be finding ground through the coolant of that piece of equipment, alright, is only 3 or 4 seconds. And the dome light does not take a lot of current draw, so there's not much of the current going to ground or electrical activity going to ground because the door is not open for a long time and the light bulb does not draw a lot of amperage. Now, let's compare that to the starter motor, the cranking motor on a piece of equipment. Well, the cranking motor takes a lot of amperage, a lot of current, but is not evoked for a long period of time. So it goes, you turn the key, you crank it over, the engine starts, and you release the key. So if there were a faulty ground and electrolysis was occurring through the coolant, all right, there would be a lot more damage with the cranking motor because of its current draw than the dome light, but it also was not evoked for such a long period of time, so it may take a year or 2 years for that to show up, simply because you'd start, maybe you'd only start the engine 3 times a day or 4 times a day. All right, but every time it did start it, it would be putting a heavy electrical load, is probably the best way to say it, on that coolant to come to ground. So what we have to realize is that it's the matter of the electrical load and what we would call in engineering the duty cycle, the amount of time that that load is evoked, are going to determine how detrimental and how quickly the damage from electrolysis will occur. And that is why, to revisit again, that's why the tires causing a lot of static electricity on the road and driving for a long period of time is very, very detrimental to over-the-road trucks and also a passenger vehicle. You have a pickup truck, you have a car, it's the same thing, all right? Is that if it's finding its ground path through the coolant and you drive 100 miles a day and it has a faulty ground, then for 100 miles a day you're deteriorating something. And it almost becomes the part that becomes deteriorated almost acts like a sacrificial ground, right? So we need to keep this in mind. Now, what are the telltale signs of a engine or a piece of equipment that has that is possibly falling prey to electrolysis? Well, historically, when you do have a high impedance ground, that electrical circuit may not work to 100%. So you may turn the key on the starter to start an engine. I don't care, this could be a liquid cooled UTV, right? Or it could be a Class 8 combine, what have you. It makes no difference. So the thing is that you turn the key and it either, you know, doesn't crank right away or it cranks funny and then starts to go and gets momentum, all right? You could have a electrical circuit that's maybe not as efficient as it should be. Let's say you turn the headlights on and the headlights are not as bright as they used to be, but not something, they're not like candles. So you kind of, you say, eh, maybe it's my eyes or maybe it's darker today or whatever, or maybe the headlights are dirty and you don't think of it. It could be something like a fan motor. A coolant fan on an engine, right? And you might say, geez, you know, this thing takes, once the fan evokes, the electric fan in front of the radiator, once that evokes, it takes a little bit longer to cool down. And that would probably even be a hard one for you to determine what's at all. Or another major player as far as electrolysis is concerned is the blower motor inside the passenger compartment of a vehicle or a piece of farm equipment, because historically that blower motor runs all the time. Is that you could have it on vent in a cooler weather, it could be on defrost, it could be on heat, it could be on air conditioner, and in most applications that blower motor, even albeit at a slow speed, is running and moving the air into that passenger compartment, be it a pickup truck or a combine. Right, so they're of great detriment because it doesn't take a lot of amperage. It takes more than a light bulb, but its duty cycle, its length of time running, is so long. And what will happen, getting back to the blow motor, is that often in a lot of applications there'll be one wire on the bolts that hold it, because most heater cases today, or heater boxes, they call it a plastic. So plastic is not a good ground, right? It's not a conductor of electricity. Well, so there'll usually be either a tang with a wire on it for a ground wire or something, and during a service procedure, somebody's working on it, or they change the heater core, or they change something, but underneath the dash, they knock it off. That's not the ground for the blower motor, because the blower motor has the two plugs going to the motor, because it's a DC circuit, battery and ground, so the blower motor works fine, but that extra ground wire that's going to one of the bolts is actually to eliminate the static electricity and to be able to turn that to a ground path that's going to go to the chassis someplace eventually, and not find a path through coolant or something else. So to start to bring this now to a little bit more clarity is that anything that is electrically operated has the potential to create electrolysis. Anything that has contact with the ground and travels at a high speed has the potential to create electrolysis. You have a rubber track machine that has the potential to create electrolysis through the friction of the track riding on the ground. Is it as great as an 18-wheeler? Of course not, right? But it still has the potential there. And just like depleting soil, the depletion of your soil, what we would call mining the soil, right, and not taking care of the soil, it does not happen overnight. It happens over time. And these failures from electrolysis usually happen over time, and the bad thing about it is that the person just writes it off as a failure. Hey, that left wheel bearing went bad again, Joey. You know, that Kenworth's making noise, that left wheel bearing is starting to growl again, we better change that. Well, if it keeps eating wheel bearings and it's not eating the right side and not eating the others, and you're not doing the installation wrong, then there's a light bulb that should go off in your head and say, hey, there's something else going on here. So now, what would be the telltale signs of electrolysis? All right, they are either unexplained pinholes in parts that come in contact with the coolant, specifically aluminum parts. So let's say that you have a radiator and the radiator fails and starts to leak, and you pressure check. Check this radiator. So, you know, let me back up for a minute. When something fails, and there's, and I don't care just about electrolysis, but anything fails, you have to not just be like a monkey and replace the part. You have to do a certain level of forensics. It's like with a pump, right? A pump fails, and it's failing because of cavitation, because one of the lines is sucking closed and starving the pump. You go put a new pump on there, and it's going to cavitate again, and it's going to be destroyed. All right? So you have to do a certain level of forensics or whatever it is, a failure. But if you take a radiator out, a heater core, an oil cooler, anything that has coolant going through it, even though if it has something else going through it, coolant going through it, and it has numerous pinholes someplace in it. Now, the pinhole could be in the tube, the pinhole could be in the tank, the pinhole could be in the connected with the tubes, brazed together is brazed, I'm looking for the word. If it has numerous holes, say, man, look at this thing, it's got 10 little holes, so it's got holes all over the place. That is the hallmark of electrolysis. And if you just replace that part without doing anything else, then it is going to fail again. Same thing is with an intake manifold. If you have an intake manifold that has coolant in it, I don't care, gas or diesel, has an intake manifold that has coolant in it, and it starts to get, it looks almost like porosity, a lot of little pinholes in one area. It may be overheat in one area in the front left runner, and then not be to the back, and then in the back again, and everything else in between could look beautiful, because we can't, as I said, we can't determine where the electricity will find the easiest ground path, and it may actually jump back and forth between the two ground paths. As one becomes a little bit more eroded, then it'll find another one, and that one becomes eroded, jump back to the other one. So it's going to go for the path of least resistance. So if you have failures that do not look normal, don't write them off and destroy your arms and go, all right, the crop died, that's it, forget about it, crop died. No, we have to look at it. Just like you would analyze a nutrient deficiency in a crop, you have to analyze this and look at the parts. So, bearing failure, cooling system failure, radiator, heater core, oil coolers, anything that has coolant and a liquid in they could use for a ground path, is that, let's say, arguably, you have a transmission, and it has a bearing fail in the transmission. And now that's not impossible for it to fail, all right, but if it failed and you want to look at the bearing and you want to study it and say, well, geez, you know, this bearing looks a little bit, it looks like, well, it got hot. It got, you know, obviously it got hot because it was failing, but you may want to study the balls in it. If it were the roller bearing, study the rollers, are they pitted? And, you know, and it's, the forensic stuff is not 100%, but it's going to steer you into the proper direction, because by looking at things forensically, you're trying to identify where the failure was. If you say, man, you know, my son never put oil back in the transmission, grease back in the transmission, that's where the bearing failed. Well, that's your answer. So it is important for you to understand that. Now, how can you check for electrolysis? That's wonderful. I gave you all this. You're saying, well, how do I check for this? It is very, very simple, but you will need, most likely you will need two people. And what you're going to do is you're going to use a voltmeter, and you could use a digital voltmeter, and you're going to put it on the lowest scale, which would be usually 0 to 2 volts, or 0 to 20 volts. And what you will do is you will take the negative lead of the voltmeter and hook it up to a good ground. It could be the battery negative ground. It could be a good, clean, tight engine ground. It has to be a good ground. All right. You may have to make up a jumper wire for this, and you're going to, so the battery ground is usually the best place to go, the negative terminal of the battery. All right. And then what you're going to do is you are going to take the positive lead of the voltmeter, and you are going to stick it into the coolant. Now, you may have to stick it into the coolant in a surge tank, depending upon the application. Or you may be able to take the radiator cap off and stick it into the coolant there. But the caveat, and this is very important, and specifically if you're sticking it into a radiator or some sort of metal or aluminum or ferrous container, is that the end of the voltmeter probe needs to be in the coolant and not to touch anything. So you can't put the voltmeter probe in. Let's say if you took a radiator cap off and put it and touched the core or touch one of the tubes. It has to be just surrounded by coolant without touching anything. All right? So now that is so to recap, negative lead to battery ground, voltmeter on a low scale, 0 to 20 volts, 0 to 2 volts, whatever you may have there, all right? And then what you're going to do is you're going to put the positive lead in the coolant, and it's not going to be able to, you can't allow it to touch anything. And you're going to take a reading. Now, what's basically going to happen is that if you've had electrolysis going on and it was very bad, that you will actually pick up a charge in that coolant. And you may pick up 0.2 of a volt in that coolant, which is not good. Alrighty? But you'll probably, don't be alarmed if you pick up a stray voltage, 0.002001. That's just a stray voltage, and that's usually just an electrolytic effect from the chemicals in the coolant that's acting like a slight battery. That's not hurting anything. Alright? So for all intents purposes, you should have very, very near zero. The next thing what you're going to do is you need to evoke different circuits. So what you're going to do is have your helper go, and what he's going to do is he's going to, or she's going to, crank the engine. The best thing to do is to disable the engine so it does not start. All right? And then you don't have to crank it for an hour and kill a battery. So you want to crank the engine while you're taking a voltmeter reading in the coolant. Because if everything else is good and the ground is bad for the cranking circuit, the engine may crank fine because it's finding its ground path to the coolant. So now if you crank the engine and your helper cranks the engine and you see 1 volt on the coolant, then you know that there's electrolysis occurring and it is it's finding a path through that coolant. When the engine starts, there's no voltage there because it's the cranking motor evoking it. And you want to go about and do this with everything. So you first want to check the cranking circuit. All right. The next step you want to do is check higher electrical loads. You may want to now the engine is running, put the headlights on, put the air conditioner on, put the blower motor on high. You then put the rear window defroster, if it has electric rear window defroster. Do that, and you want to evoke all of the electrical loads, and then at one particular point, you want to try to have everything on at the same time with your helper turning it on. So you have the engine running, you have the headlights on, you have the air conditioner on, you have the wipers on, you have rear window defroster on, if that is applicable, what have you. So what you're basically doing is you're checking each circuit independently, and then you are collectively checking the whole electrical load, because you could have just a culmination of a high impedance main ground, and you will have that voltage drop. You'll find that voltage in the coolant. So it is that simple to do. All righty? It's that simple to do. You're going to check each circuit independently. This is whether it's a farm tractor, whether it's a combine, whether it's a sprayer, whether it's a semi or what have you. Right, is that now if you had a semi and you are going to and you're building up a lot of static electricity from the tires, is that you will see a very high stray voltage of maybe 6/10 of a volt, 7/10 of a volt in that coolant with it at rest with everything off. All right, so to recap, very simple, your voltmeter, ground, battery ground, low scale so you have a lot of resolution. And then you need to evoke the circuit, start with the highest electrical load, which is the starter motor, crank the engine over, and then see what happens. If that's a good test if you're buying a piece of equipment that's used, but a better test, as I've said before, is to go and take a coolant sample and look for elemental metals in that coolant sample. If there's elemental metals in that coolant sample, then there's been either cylinder liner cavitation erosion or electrolysis taking place, but at that particular point, you cannot determine what it is. All you know is that it's eating away at the inside of that engine. All right? Now, this would be a good test for you to do, specifically with the cranking circuit on your equipment once a year. Once a year, before you change the coolant, and if you look at the coolant, if it has a lot of nitrates that are depleted, there's a very good possibility that electrolysis is occurring. So don't just put that coolant test strip in there and say, oh man, it needs some SCA. If it's deteriorating at a greater rate than normal, then you need to be able to look for electrolysis. And like I said, it really, with a helper, it takes 5 minutes. So it's probably harder to get to the site to stick the voltmeter positive probe in the coolant than to do anything else. So once a year, make it out that you check for electrolysis on all your equipment, because that will definitely eat a cylinder liner and puke that motor. No two way about it. And you don't want to puke a $30,000 diesel motor or a $4,000 engine or a four anything. You don't want to puke it. And it's very simple for you to be able to determine that. And another telltale sign is coolant that gets depleted as far as its supplemental coolant additives very quickly, more than or faster than it should be for the use. And now, to talk about cylinder liner cavitation erosion, that is basically a cavitation like you would have in a pump, and it's from the liner vibrating and the harmonics going through the engine. People call it ringing the bell and what have you from the combustion event, but that is an effect that is predominantly found in wet sleeve engines, not parent material of the bore. So it's not a parent material bore. So if you have an engine that does not have a sleeve in it, then what it's called, the bore, is usually called the parent material, because it's the parent being the engine block material. But keep in mind that most newer engines today that do not have a liner, but are thin wall castings, and they're thin wall castings to save weight for fuel economy, and they too can suffer from cylinder liner cavitation erosion, especially light duty diesels. So if you look at a lot of light duty diesels that are found in pickup trucks and maybe some other applications like smaller farm tractors, a utility tractor, a zero turn mower, a gen set or what have you, even though it may not have a cylinder liner in it, you want to look at that, what that manufacturer says, and that is usually why they will specify a certain type of coolant along with other aspects of the engine, the materials that are in it, and may actually also require the use of a supplemental coolant additive, is because you could still get cavitation erosion through there. Because it's not ringing, it's not the same ringing or harmonic that you would have with creating the bubbles, and the bubbles imploding on the cylinder wall, and on the from the actually comes from the back side of the liner, from the coolant side that worked their way into the bore, because that bore is so thin that those same dynamics that come into play. Once again, to reiterate, is that you can have you can have that happen detect that with a coolant analysis, but you will not be able to tell whether it's from electrolysis or from cavitation liner erosion. Alrighty? So if you have any questions on that, it's very simple. Recap, it's a voltmeter test. If you have something funny happen and the heater core starts to leak, you study, it's got a whole bunch of pinholes in it. Alright, radiator starts leaking, a whole bunch of pinholes. Unusual wheel bearing failure on one side. Alright, that are all the telltale signs of electrolysis and a bad ground and static electricity going through that and finding a ground pad. Then again, very, very common with older long-haul trucks that farmers use, because at one particular point they may have been in an accident, they may have had an engine out, they may have had a transmission out, and a ground wire or a ground cable was left off. The vehicle would run fine. You would never know it until it ate the cylinder liner or ate a wheel bearing. All right, so now we're going to do our special delivery, and that is brought to you by Firestone Ag, a company founded by a farmer, Harvey Firestone. I love that guy, even though I never met him, obviously. And he was a fourth-generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. Harvey dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and his innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today, and lives on with their 23-degree tread bar, AD2 technology, IF and VF tires, and their latest, the Firestone of tracks, their replacement tracks. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone, and Firestone is proud to say that their tires are made in USA in I think it's a 105-acre facility in Iowa, right in the heart of farm country. So check it out. Firestone, baby. Farm hard. All right, so now we have our letter here, and it says, "Hello, Ray. I have been a fan of yours for years and a listener of your show since the beginning." Well, thank you for that. "I follow all your advice." Don't tell my wife that. "I follow your advice and have never had an issue with any one of my cars." Thank you. "My question is concerning my gasoline turbo direct injection engine in my 2017 Ford Focus. I live in Las Vegas, Nevada, where we have mild winters. During that time, my car was averaging 28 miles per gallon, and now that it's significantly warmer, my car is averaging 31 miles per gallon. I use the car mostly to go to and from work, 42 miles round trip, and all freeway, and I use high test fuel. I have read about summer and winter fuels. I'm just not sure why a turbocharged intercooled engine would do better in hot weather than in cold weather. Thank you for taking the time to impart all your knowledge. It's been so beneficial through the years. Thank you, Gene Wurst, Las Vegas, Nevada." Well, thank you, Gene, for listening and for writing. And you're probably going to be the impetus for a show next month or so about understanding gasoline, and you are 100% correct, is that there are winter blends and summer blends of fuel, and usually the aromatic content of that fuel is different ignite easier in the cold weather, and to give off less emissions due to vapor pressure different times of year. So they're a fuel that's going to they're special, and they're called boutique blends of fuel. Alright, so let me collect my thoughts. So it is very possible that historically a winter blend of fuel will have less energy content due to the standards it needs to meet as far as the emission output with the rich mixture on what they call transition or intermediate stage from cold start to warm up and during crank when it's cold, because there'll be more residual hydrocarbons left over in the engine as it just fires, because it needs a richer mixture to ignite when it is colder out, because the rate of vaporization of the fuel changes. So basically, in essence, in a simplistic nutshell, is that usually winter fuel has less energy content than summer blends of fuel historically. All right, so you're going to have some mileage loss there, and depending upon the criteria of the fuel for that particular area, you say you live in Las Vegas, that particular area, it may even have less. You may be getting a West Coast blend, like a California type of blend, which has even a greater energy loss with its winter blend than a blend that we would have in New Jersey here. And that's due to the local environmental conditions, the altitude, the mountains, the state laws, and what have you. So you may be getting a lot of California fuel there, or California type fuel, not that it's necessarily blended in California. So the energy content is paramount to your fuel economy, and to answer your question, yes, that it is less than summer fuel. But the other thing that comes into play is that, which a lot of people don't think of it, they blame the fuel. I would say the fuel energy content is predominantly the problem or the cause of your loss of fuel economy. But the other thing that we have to think about is that the rolling resistance, even if you keep your tires pumped up, and it sounds, and I know that you do, right, with the proper pressure, that the rolling resistance when the tire is cold and the ground is colder, right, the tire is going to become stiffer and it's not going to want to roll. And if it's a performance type of tire, it's even going to have more of a negative or exaggerated impact on its rolling resistance as the weather gets cold. And that is going to cause more of a parasitic loss in the drivetrain. And the other thing that people don't think about is that the aerodynamics of the vehicle change. Not that the physical vehicle changes, but if you have colder air, the air is denser, and when it's denser, it is going to cause more wind resistance going across the body of that car. Now, you say you have a 2017 Focus, that's a very aerodynamic car, but there will still be an increase in airflow resistance over that body. It could be a rocket ship, all right, or a fighter plane. It's still going to have an increase in resistance over that aerodynamic drag as that weather gets colder. And so when you put it all together, when you have a decreased energy content of the fuel, you have possibly a tire that's going to have dramatically more rolling resistance when it's cold than when it's warm outside, and you have the increased aerodynamic drag, then what you put, you add those up, and you're losing, about based upon your numbers, you're losing, let's say, from 28, let me look at email, to I think 33, which is quite a difference. That's 5 miles per gallon. So that's quite a big difference. And what you may want to try to do is, during next winter, buy different brand of gasoline and see whether that they have a little bit more energy content than normal. And you may also want to try to put if the tires, let's say, arguably call for 32 pounds all year round, you may want to run 34 in the winter to try to help that. But if the car has a performance tire on it and what have you, and it's definitely going to have higher drag, and you'd be surprised how much that impacts fuel economy. So in a nutshell, to recap, less dense fuel, try a different brand of fuel. If you frequent one, you may find that it's not going to be any different there. Put a couple more pounds of air in the tire, and that's basically it. It's just like, it's just nature. It's Mother Nature showing you that she's always in command. God shows you that he's in command, right? So listen, thank you so much for your letter. If you have any further questions, please contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And I thank you all for listening. You have a blessed week, and I hope that everybody has able to get some seed in the ground. And if you can't get seed in the ground, just know that our Lord will provide. And it's not the end of the world, and I don't say that tritely. It's not the end of the world. Just put your trust and hope in the Lord, and then use this time to ask the Lord to what you need to learn from this, and also use this time to maybe make your farm better for next year. So listen, just always remember that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher. You have a blessed day, and hopefully you can listen next week. Thank you.